The Smoke Daddies jam at Jesse's Roadhouse in Merrick, and Blue Matters jamming at the Brightwaters Inn. In New York City, it's the Scatolites and Rudy Crew at the Knitting Factory, Motu and the Roadhouse Jesters at Cornelia Street Cafe at 9 p.m., at Terminal 5, it's Ladytron, and at Sullivan Hall, it's Billy's Band. And here's today's thought of the day. Ability can take you to the top, but it takes character to keep you there. Thank you for listening to the Concert Billboard and to WUSB Stony Brook.
Where it's 3 minutes after 6 o'clock, time for Off the Wall. Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday afternoon, evening, what have you. And there's a lot of excitement and buzz going on around here at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Why? Because, well, there are a few things. It's always exciting to know that you might be amongst a rather selective group of institutions, of locations that are highly desirable by certain other entities, other individuals, different agendas, things like that. And basically, we don't have the confirmation yet. We don't know for sure because it's being kept kind of hush hush. But more than 7,000 facilities, from chemical plants to colleges, have been designated high risk sites for potential terrorist attacks, according to the Department of Homeland Security. And the rumors are being whispered in the hallways is that Stony Brook is on that list somewhere. Yeah, so there's a lot of excitement because it's sort of like a who's who. You know, if you make it 7,000 sounds like a lot, I know, but not everybody makes it onto this list of the high risk locations. And I think by being on the list, we qualify for some kind of additional funding and certainly a lot more tourists and things like that. So, a lot of excitement. Now, this week, this story was written last week, so this week, the department will send letters to the facilities notifying them that they present the highest potential consequences in the event of a successful terrorist attack. And Stony Brook is always about highest potential consequences, no matter what. So, yeah, I think it's a slam dunk, to be honest. The facilities include chemical plants, hospitals, colleges and universities, oil and natural gas production and storage sites, and food and agricultural processing and distribution centers. In other words, every place in the country, apparently, you'll be within a stone's throw of one of these high risk targets. Regrettably, the names of the sites will not be released to the public. I guess there's rationale behind that. You know, don't tell the public where the high-risk sites are, because then they might avoid them, and then they won't be high-risk anymore, or the terrorist will pick another site, and then that will become high-risk, except the people won't know about it until something blows up, and then they'll say, oh, this was a high-risk site after all. Yeah, you know, why not just release all the sites and just really mess up the terrorist day, because they'll say, oh, they know. They know this is a high-risk site. How is it any different than going into a shopping mall and blowing the whole place up? Is that not a high risk target? I mean, it is to the people that are in there, you know. I don't know how blowing up a hospital or a college is any different than blowing up a shopping center. It's just another level of paranoia that we are releasing today. The department compiled a list after reviewing information submitted by 32,000 facilities. 32,000 facilities were in the running. Only 7,000 apparently came out of this successful. It considered factors such as proximity to population centers, the volatility of chemicals on site, and how the chemicals are stored and handled. Well, we've got chemicals here. I know we have chemicals. I've seen them. We definitely have chemicals. In fact, some of the doorways in various biology labs and chemistry labs, they've got those little radiation symbols. I don't think it's really they're doing anything that mysterious and dangerous, but they're required to have those little radiation stickers, and they're kind of cool to see as you're walking down the hallway. So we've got the chemicals. We're within a stone's throw of East Setauket, and that's a population center, and the old Stony Brook is down the hill. And we got Center Reach. That's not far away. A lot of people are crammed into Center Reach and Selden and places like that. So yeah, we've got there's people that live around here for sure. And Long Island, it's like the number one radio market in the country. Not saying that we measure up in the radio market by any stretch of the imagination, but I think we qualify. I think we qualify. But how do we find out? That's what I don't understand. How do we ever find out if we're on this list? They're not going to release it to the public. Obviously, somebody within the administration, and I know we have a lot of moles out there, and we love you. We really do, because you feed us all the information. Just photocopy it or fax it or something, just so that we know for sure that that we're on the list. It means something. It's, you know, I realize we'd be the same site, we'd be the same location without this distinction. But it does matter. It does mean something to be recognized. And I think that's sort of the unspoken rule in any college or institution. You want to be amongst the most high-risk sites in the country. What else can we tell you about this? Experts long have worried that terrorists could attack chemical facilities near large cities, in essence turning them into large bombs. Experts say it is a hallmark of Al-Qaeda in particular to leverage a target nation's technological or industrial strength against it, as terrorists did in the September 11th terrorist attack. So actually, it's flying airplanes into buildings. I guess that's using technological or industrial strength, even though every single country in the world has airplanes and buildings. The department said on Friday the list is the first step in its plan to reduce the consequences of an attack. I don't know what the second step is going to be. Basically moving everybody out and making another site someplace else that they don't tell anybody about? I don't know. It first compiled a list of approximately 320 chemicals of interest. Chemicals of interest. not people of interest, chemicals of interest, and determined what amounts of each chemical should raise concerns. Then came the consequence analysis, which examined where a facility was, and the expected impact of a chemical release or an explosion. They must have so much fun just brainstorming. What if we release a whole bunch of this radioactive plutonium here, right on this intersection, and then we drive a Mack truck into a building and cause this huge fireball explosion? What kind of effect would that have on the neighboring kindergarten? But what they must go through in a typical afternoon of brainstorming. Boy, who are these people anyway? We looked at how the chemicals were packaged for storage, how they were containerized for shipment. Containerized? Is that even a word? Containerized for shipment. What happened to contained? I mean, that would work just as well, containerized. I don't know. Could the chemicals be taken off-site by one person with relatively little effort? Or would they require a crane or some type of giant vehicular conveyance? The 7,000 facilities will have 90 days to conduct site-specific assessments of security vulnerabilities. So I guess that's the clue here at Stony Brook. If we see people walking around conducting site-specific assessments of security vulnerabilities, there you go, all right? Then we know we've qualified. All right, so we're going to be keeping our eyes out for that. conducting site-specific assessments of security vulnerabilities. And also in the coming months, the department will conduct additional assessments, divide the facilities into four tiers, and help the plants develop security plans. Plants. They're not all plants, you know. If it's a university, it's not a plant. We're not plants. Anyway, first will be Tier 1. They just love calling things with these silly names. Tier 1, consisting of plants with the biggest potential for disaster. That's always been Stony Brook's motto. The biggest potential for disaster. It will then check to ensure that they are complying with the security plans. The regulations address a variety of factors, including fencing. But, you know, against a terrorist, somebody with a sword is not going to get very far, all right? So fencing, just throw that out. That's not going to make any difference whatsoever. What else? Background checks of employees and restrictions on who can enter plants. It's funny how this story suddenly turned into plants and just ignored all the other things they were talking about. I want to put enough complexity into the mix, said the DHS spokesperson, that Al-Qaeda will go somewhere else. Well, they're going to go somewhere else then. You're not really stopping it. You're just basically killing somebody else instead. Yeah, they're just going to go someplace else. Well, let's go to the elementary school down the road. Yeah, that's easier. I'm trying to complicate these guys' lives, he says. Yeah. The agency is trying to address these threats posed by chemical facilities, the possibility of hazardous materials leaks, fires, and explosions, the possibility that materials could be stolen and used elsewhere, and possibly dangerous contamination of chemicals. Maybe less chemicals would be the answer as well. Amazing. All right, we'll be having more information on that as it plays out. I'm sure it will. But, you know, that whole containerizing or whatever that word was reminds me of something else that that was released in the last week. This comes out of England. British bureaucrats have been warned, no more synergies, stakeholders, or sustainable communities. You know what I'm talking about. The body that represents the country's local authorities has told its members to stop using management buzzwords, saying they confuse people and prevent residents from understanding what local governments do. The Local Government Association, whose members include hundreds of district, town, and county councils in England and Wales, on Friday sent out a list of 100 non-words. Is that even a word? Non-words? I don't know. At least they put it in quotes. They say officials should avoid if they want to be understood. And this is in England, where the language is already pretty weird. I know they invented it, but come on. I mean, why do you call trucks lorries? I never could figure that one out. Someone tell me that. All right, I'm going to get a lot of mail now. The list includes the popular but vague term empowerment. Coterminosity? That's a situation in which two organizations oversee the same geographical area. Coterminosity. And synergies, combinations in which the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Officials were told to ditch the term revenue stream for income, as well as the imprecise sustainable communities. The association also said councils should stop referring to local residents as customers or stakeholders. The association's chairman, Simon Milton, said officials should not hide behind impenetrable jargon and phrases. Why do we have to have coterminous stakeholder engagement when we could just talk to people instead, he said. The association sent its letter after reports that one town council had told staff to use the term, are you ready? Thought showers. That's right, thought showers instead of brainstorming. And some people might say brainstorming is bad enough. Officials at Tunbridge Wells Council in southern England felt brainstorming might offend people with epilepsy. Could not make this up. And that's a condition that involves periodic electrical storms inside the brain. It's kind of cool, isn't it? Electrical storms inside your brain. Anyway, the National Society for Epilepsy said it had surveyed its members and they did not find the term offensive. What a relief. But yeah, you know, all this jargonese going on out. Is that even a word, jargonese? I mean, I could have just as easily said jargon. But it's like we have this need to just invent more words that don't mean anything. Just as a way of of making it so that you can't understand what the other person is saying, or so that they can't understand what you're saying. So you appear to be important. There's all kinds of jargon in radio. You know, I could talk about pots instead of dials, and you know, carts instead of announcements, and things like that. There's all kinds of words you can use so that you can talk to fellow radio people, and they know what you're talking about. But the average person on the street has no conception, and they say, "Wow, this person's speaking gibberish. They must know what they're talking about." And that's true of every single profession in the world, from brain surgery to fixing a street. Everyone's got their own little words for things. And it drives me crazy sometimes, because I think of how much could we understand of what's going on in things that we're not familiar with if only normal words were used. And this is certainly true in the computer world. It's true in that an awful lot. Just read a technical paper and you'll see all kinds of jargon that, if you can't get through that, how are you ever going to understand the concept? Yeah, it really drives me crazy sometimes. I try to avoid it. Try to avoid it whenever possible. It can be hard. And sometimes people get mad at you. They get mad at you when you don't use the exact piece of jargon that they're trained to understand. I will not use the word solution, okay? I mean, I'll use the word solution if there's a problem to be solved. I'll say, oh, I have the solution. But I'm not going to refer to a product as a solution. I hate that so much. we'll sell you a solution. And this is before the problem has even been defined. They're defining the solution. Nah, I just can't do it. I can't. I've seen a lot of my friends go down that road, and it's sad. They don't realize it, but it's really pathetic. All right. This is interesting. Some interesting news here, again, from Google. And, yeah, I've got mixed feelings about them on various other issues. But as far as this goes, this is pretty cool. When Neil Armstrong became the first man to set foot on the moon, he uttered unforgettable words. Of course, he also messed them up, but that's another story right there. The next visitor to roam the lunar landscape may send back email instead. Welcome to a new kind of space race. Basically, the earthly guest will be a machine, and the goal is as much exploration as seeking out new business ventures. What are we talking about here? Well, this is part of the Google Lunar X Prize, which will put $20 million, that's right, you heard it right, $20 million into the hands of the first privately funded team that can land a rover on the moon, have it travel on the surface for 500 meters or more, send back data, photos, and video, and do it all by December 31st, 2012. The prize drops to $15 million after that date and goes away altogether after 2014. So, well, first of all, can you do this for under $20 million? That's what I'd like to know. I mean, you know, launching a rocket into space, it's got to cost a pretty penny, I would think. And getting it to go someplace and being able to stay in touch with it and having it send something back, and then it's got to get an account on some kind of email system and log in and do all that, that adds to the cost a little bit. $20 million? I don't know. But I guess it would be nice to break even, not lose all that. But I have to wonder, what if this really takes off? What if everybody is into this and you have just all these rockets going up into space like every 5 minutes? That could happen. Could cause a real problem. One of the main requirements of this whole venture is to have as little government involvement in the project as possible. According to Becky Ramsey, the XPRIZE Foundation's Director of Communications for Space Projects, that's a cool title to have, isn't it? We believe that space should be open to anyone and everyone, especially those people who want to go. What a bleeding heart liberal type of attitude towards space. Space belongs to everybody. Come on. We all know space belongs to the military. That's what it's for. To send all kinds of laser beams and blow things up. And that's the only way we're going to get into space. We all know this. Yeah, the government has accomplished amazing things, but we think that we can do it less expensively. Well, yeah, because Google's not spending anything until somebody else does it. And then what they're spending is not that much, really. $20 million sounds like a lot of money, but to send a little rocket ship up to the moon and have it report back to us, that's not bad. I mean, Bill Gates could do that tomorrow. He could do that. He could write a check right now for that amount of money. But could he actually get a rocket ship to go there? The ideas grew out of conversations between XPRIZE chairman Peter Diamandis and Google co-founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page. "We thought it would be a good fit," said Tiffany Montague, technical program manager at Google and the company's main representative for the Google Lunar XPRIZE. "Many of us here are interested in space as a hobby, or we came from space backgrounds. Well, some of us even came from outer space." Yes, you wonder why we are curious about all this information, about what's out there on the Internet, and why we collect everything and gather everything and read all of your email and Gmail and things like that, before she was let out of the room. Continuing, though, Google, which is paying the main prize purse, $30 million total, including bonus prizes, hopes the competition will result in education, interesting new content, and inspiration. What I think this prize is really about is inspiring young minds and inspiring the global population to compete for a dream. There are 13 teams officially competing in the race, but the XPRIZE Foundation expects that number to grow to about 25. The multinational lineup includes Americans, Italians, Romanians, and a mystery team. Yeah, it's probably those space aliens, which can hide its identity until July 20th, 2009, under the rules. The competitors include university students, business people, engineers, robotics experts, and even students. All teams are considered serious contenders, but not all of them are expected to be able to complete the task. In fact, you can look forward to some spectacular failures. "I liken our teams to the garage bands of the space exploration world," she said in search of a soundbite. "These are the people who have a dream, who have a passion, who have the knowledge and ability and the drive, and they think they can do this. So we're giving them the opportunity. The teams face a number of daunting tasks, including figuring out how and where to launch, designing a craft that can complete the journey, and making sure it can execute a required soft landing." Can you imagine that? If you figure out how to get a rocket ship all the way to the moon, and then it just sort of crashes into a rock, and that's the end of it, and you lose the prize and everything. Yeah, the craft has to alight on the moon, a little like you'd expect an insect or a bird to land here on Earth, and it means that you can't impact or crash into the surface at high speed, unless you really want to. And once they land, the rovers must be ready to cope with extreme conditions. And that includes a vacuum environment, radiation, temperature extremes, soft terrain, all sorts of things like that. And another big obstacle is the money. Reaching for the moon, literally, is an immensely pricey endeavor, and the mission is likely to cost much more than the $20 million first prize, a fact the sponsors freely recognize. Well, good for them. I'm glad you're recognizing the fact that this is all going to be a loss of money for whoever wins. I think what's important to keep in mind is that this is an incentive prize and is not meant to cover the cost of development. Instead, it is meant to be a catalyst to shake up industry and inspire breakthrough. Of course, you know, Google can probably spend $20 billion on this and might inspire a whole lot more breathtaking endeavors. Anyway, it's a good idea, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes out of it. Anything that gets us back to the moon or just back into space is a good thing. I don't see how people can argue with this, but people do. People argue all the time, saying, well, got to fix all the problems here on Earth before we can do anything. And you know what? That means we're never going to go anyplace. Never. The only future of the human race is to expand the boundaries, go other places, get off of this rock and find alternatives. Do things right the second time or the third time and just continue learning more about where we came from and what it all means. All right, let's take a look at some of the fun stuff that's happened in the world over the last week. And by fun, usually I mean stupid, like this one. School administrators in Ohio voted Friday to begin the process of firing a middle school teacher accused of burning a cross into a student's arm and refusing to keep his religious beliefs out of the classroom. Oh, my God. You know, I want to say only in Ohio, but it wouldn't be true. This is the kind of lunacy that goes on all throughout our country. The Mount Vernon School Board passed a resolution to terminate the employment of John Freshwater, an eighth-grade science teacher, for the past 21 years. Freshwater, according to an independent report, used an electrostatic device to mark a cross on the arm of one of his students, causing pain to the student. The night of the incident. Night of the incident? What's he doing burning crosses into students' arms at night? Daytime I could understand, but nighttime science classes? I don't know about that. A mark was left that lasted for approximately 3 weeks, so at least it wasn't a permanent thing. According to the Ohio Department of Education, the student's family has filed a lawsuit. Big surprise there, eh? Freshwater was also reprimanded several times for refusing to move his Bible from his classroom desk and teaching creationism alongside evolution. Now, explain to me something. How does somebody get to be a science teacher for 21 years if they refuse to not teach creationism next to the subject they're supposed to be teaching, which is science, which is, it flies completely in the face of creationism? You know, it's the exact opposite. The report also cites evidence that Mr. Freshwater told his students that science is wrong because the Bible states that homosexuality is a sin, here we go, and so anyone who is gay chooses to be gay and is therefore a sinner. Yeah, science, that's what it's all about. 21 years of that nut teaching kids. All right. Just when you think it can't get any worse, though. On a Monday morning last month, Highway Patrol officers visited 20 classrooms at El Camino High School in Oceanside, California, to announce some horrible news. Several students had been killed in car wrecks over the weekend. Classmates wept. Some became hysterical. A few hours and many tears later, though, the pain turned to fury when the teenagers learned that it was all a hoax. A scared straight exercise designed by school officials to dramatize the consequences of drinking and driving. Yes, as seniors prepared for graduation parties, school officials in the largely prosperous San Diego suburb are defending themselves against allegations that they went too far. At school assemblies, some students held posters that read, "Death is real, don't play with our emotions." One student who was in physics class when an officer announced that her missing classmate, David, a popular basketball player, had died instantly. They actually used real people. They used real names. They had died instantly after being rear-ended by a drunken driver. She said she felt nauseated but was too stunned to cry. They got the shock they wanted, she said. Some of her classmates became extremely upset, prompting the teacher to tell them immediately that it was all staged. People started yelling at the teacher. It was pretty hectic. Boy, I do more than yell, that's for damn sure. Others, including many who heard the news of the 26 deaths between classes, 26 deaths, were left in the dark until the missing students reappeared hours later. Can you imagine how scary that would be? Having the dead students suddenly walk through the door? Oh, my God. You feel betrayed by your teachers and administrators, these people you trust, said a 15-year-old student. But then I feel selfish for feeling that way because, I mean, if it saves one life, it's worth it. Oh, please. How does it save a life? This just makes you not trust anybody and scares the crap out of you for no good reason. Yeah, you can teach how to be safe and responsible without resorting to measures like this. This is traumatic for reasons that you might think are good reasons, but really cause more harm than good. Guidance counselor Lori Tauber, who helped organize the shocking exercise and got dozens of students to participate, said, "They were traumatized, but we wanted them to be traumatized. That's how they get the message." Why don't you work in Guantanamo Bay with that attitude? The plan was to tell the truth to the students at an assembly later in the day. But word that it was all a hoax began to spread before the gathering. Some counselors and administrators revealed the truth to calm some students who had become upset. Unbelievable. And you know what's going to happen? If this really does happen in the future, if somebody does die in a car crash, nobody's going to believe them. Yeah, it'll be the boy who cried wolf. No one's going to believe when it actually does happen. So you really sort of blew it there. All right. What, more stupidity? We want more stupidity? There's plenty to go around. There's plenty of stupid stories out there. A man wearing a T-shirt depicting a cartoon character holding a gun was stopped from boarding a flight by security at Heathrow's Terminal 5 in London. You've probably heard this story. It's been making the rounds. Brad Jayakoti from Bayswater Central London said he was stumped at the, which I guess means stunned for Americans, at the objection to his Transformers T-shirt. That's right. He was wearing a Transformers T-shirt in an airport. He said he had to change before boarding, and security officers objected to the gun held by the cartoon character. The airport operator, BAA, said it was investigating the incident. Happened a few weeks ago when he was challenged by an official during a pre-flight security check. The security officer said, "We want people to let you through because your T-shirt has got a gun on it." I was like, "What are you talking about?" The official supervisor comes over and says, "Sorry, we can't let you through, and you've got a gun on your T-shirt." Mr. Giacotti said he had to strip and change his T-shirt there before he was allowed to board his flight. "I was just looking for someone with a bit of common sense," he said. "It's a cartoon robot. What threat is it to security or offensive to anyone at all?" A BAA spokesman said there was no record of the incident and no formal complaint had been made. If a T-shirt had a rude word or a bomb on it, for example, a passenger may be asked to remove it. We are investigating what happened to see if it came under this category. If it's offensive, we don't want other passengers upset. How about the passenger you're upsetting by asking to remove a cartoon character T-shirt right there in an airport terminal? That's not really making us very safe doing this. Okay, what can we look forward to in New York? We can look forward to more use of tasers. Yes, there's a good chance one of us will be tasered. Police recruits and veteran officers could benefit from more frequent firearms training and a wider use of taser stun guns. That's according to a study of the NYPD's shooting habits released last Monday. The study by the RAND Corporation was commissioned in January of 2007, about 7 weeks after Sean Bell died in a hail of 50 police bullets. Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly said at the time questions about the department's effectiveness and training required an independent review. RAND researchers raised the phenomenon of reflective shooting or contagious shooting in which one officer's gunshots spur a fusillade of bullets from others in the area. Though they could not say whether the phenomenon occurred more often than in the past, they recommended that the department add reflexive shooting scenarios that include a stimulus or the sound of gunfire to sensitize officers to cues that may not be reliable and to teach them that such cues may generate unwanted responses. In basically, they had 455 shootings in 2004, 2005, and 2006. And in 25 of those shootings, the RAND group found that officers might have been able to end confrontations more quickly by using a less lethal device like a taser, which uses jolts of electricity to disable an assailant, before those encounters escalated to a point where more deadly force was necessary. The police killed someone in 3 of the 25 cases. At a news conference to outline the findings, Mr. Kelly strongly suggested that he would embrace the recommendations for a pilot program for the taser devices, though he still said he still had to distribute the report and well over 100 recommendations to those in his senior command. He said he was aware that critics had assailed the use of tasers, saying some officers tended to use them overzealously. But he said that by Wednesday, roughly 520 new tasers, which are not a substitute for handguns, would be available to about 3,500 sergeants on patrol. This was a study that's focusing on what we can do, he said. It's not a, this is just disturbing. Very disturbing, seeing this report, because, it's absolutely right. Cops use these things as substitutes for even talking to people. We've all seen videos of people being tasered for no good reason, when they could have easily been reasoned with or just talked to, all kinds of things. You basically give people certain types of weaponry, they will use them. And if you tell them this is non-deadly, which tasers have been linked to lots of deaths, actually, they'll just tend to use them more often. All right, let's take a look at some reader mail, otw@2600.com. That's our email address. This person writes in from England with some links to Al Jazeera in English, because we were talking about this last week, how Al Jazeera is not carried on any cable system or satellite system in this country, as far as I know. You can go to english.aljazeera, that's spelled aljazeera.net/English. Capital E in English, and you can listen to them live or watch them live, as you cannot do on television here. And they have this all over the world. I think the United States might be the only country that doesn't have them. This from Elisha. Dear Emmanuel, loved your bit on storytelling to make life interesting in last week's Off the Wall. On the Chromed Pork podcast, I go into these sorts of games in my episode on social engineering. That's at chromedpork.net. I figured you'd be interested. Feel free to advertise the show if you like. Better yet, make up a lie about it as a game. Okay, we'll consider that. Okay, here's another listener Unfortunately, he says he pledged $100 during the show for tickets to Hope and has not gotten the tickets nor has been charged. And, all right, you know, the only thing I can tell you right now, if you have been charged, then we have your name, obviously, and we have your address, and we'll be contacting you probably within the next week. If you have not been charged, probably best for you to get the tickets via the Hope.net website. I don't know what happened to the pledge, but there's been a lot of reports of charges not going through, and I'm told that all the charges for this show have gone through. So if yours has not, then it probably means that it won't. I'm sorry to say. I don't know why, but that's the reality of the situation. So if that is your situation, remember, it's off the wall, not off the hook, so don't confuse the two shows. Just verify that it has not, in fact, gone through, and then I would suggest getting tickets to Hope via other means. We'll sort all this out later. And yes, Hope.net continues. We have the schedule out now. Well, the list of talks. The schedule will be coming out later in the week as to when everything is. But we have 100 talks and biggest hacker conference I think we've ever done, taking place in New York City, July 18, 19, and 20 of this year, Hotel Pennsylvania. www.hope.net for more information. All right, let's read another letter here. Your last show was great. I had to comment on a few of the things you said. First of all, the lying in the beginning was just great. I believed in you and started to plan a lie to spread myself. And in the end, when you revealed you were actually lying to us, that is, you were telling the truth, I immediately thought about the famous liar's paradox. I am a liar. It seemed like a variation over that. Very interesting. I was very surprised that you talked about soccer. I don't think I've ever heard an American talking so long about soccer before. I found it very strange. It was funny to hear you saying that you found it confusing to understand the rules and follow the championship, because here in Brazil, we always talk about how watching soccer games would be much easier than following any other American sports, such as American football, baseball, and basketball. Well, don't even get me started on those, because there's all kinds of weird, bizarre rules that are attached to those sports. No question about that. But yeah, you know, I've been following the Euro 2008 tournament, and it's been so much fun. It really has. See, the thing is, I don't take a side. I don't have this loyalty to any particular team. The way I watch something like that is simply to basically have a team win me over because either they're underdogs or because they're performing some incredible feat. And I have to say, I'm really happy with the way things have turned out. We're up to the semifinal round now, and the only team in there that is a repeating champion, I believe, is Germany. So you have Germany, they're going to be playing Turkey, I think, tomorrow, and Turkey has never made it this far. And then you have Spain meeting Russia in the other semifinal. So basically, right now, any of those three teams, Spain, Russia, or Turkey, if they win, I'll be very happy. Germany, you know, I love Germany and all that, but they've won too many times. And I never pull for the winner. I always pull for the underdog. The other day, I was watching Turkey playing Croatia, and both of those teams have never really made it very far, and I didn't know who to root for. It was a scoreless tie all the way up to the end, and with I think 2 minutes left. Were they in? They were in extra time, overtime. 2 minutes left. All of a sudden, Croatia scores, and Turkey was devastated. I felt so bad for them. You know, it's like I hate to see people feeling sad and having all their spirits lost and all that kind of thing. So that wasn't good. But then, with literally a few seconds left after that, Turkey scored and equalized the score, and it was 1-1. They had to go to penalty kicks, and then one of the Croatian players missed the goal. The goalie didn't even have to block the penalty kick; he missed altogether. I felt so bad for him. You know, so then I was rooting for Croatia again. But then a second Croatian player did the same thing, and I realized, you know what, it's not so bad. They won't pick on one guy, they'll pick on two. And Turkey won in the end. I was happy because Turkey had never won before. At least, I don't think that far. So it's fun to watch if you don't have particular ties to one country or one team. And it's always a blast. And of course, nobody in this country really follows it. So, yeah, thanks for sending out. Yeah, the letter went about 3 or 4 pages. Sorry, I only was able to read that much. But thanks very much for sending it in. And thanks everybody else for sending in mail as well. Not going to have time to read any more today because we're actually going to go out on a special. Those of you who have followed the news, of course, know that we lost a giant this week, somebody who inspired so many people that I know in the radio world and just in the social world in general. And, of course, I'm talking about George Carlin, the master comedian, the person who always told it like it was, always spoke his mind, and did so up until the very end. I've heard recordings of his. In fact, we're going to play a recording from the 1970s. I think 1972 this came out. And simply incredible takes on life and religion and hypocrisy and things like that. Kept it up until his 70s. I always wanted to see this guy. I always wanted to see this guy because he was always sharp, always right on target, very cynical and somewhat embittered, but extremely funny and dead on. And, you know, I like to think that the way he went out on Sunday was probably the best way he could have gone out. Not lingering, you know, not becoming weaker and weaker, just kind of sudden with enough time to maybe say goodbye, you know, and move on to the next arena, wherever that might be. And also just staying extremely sharp up until the very end, never losing his edge. And how many of us are actually going to get to that stage where we do what we love doing up until the very end, up until that day where all of a sudden it's just over? You know, I think he could have lasted a lot longer, maybe if he had taken better care of himself, maybe if his heart hadn't gone out, you know, years earlier, and what's to say, you know, what could have happened. But as far as what he accomplished, what he did, the things he said, the people he reached, the words he said, and the offensiveness that he got out there, because it's necessary. I think he once said that it's everybody's responsibility, or maybe it's every comic's responsibility, to find that line and to cross it. And I think he also said, imagine how stupid the average American is, and then realize that half of them are dumber than that, or something along those lines. Yeah, so many good things. I want to go out with this piece by George Carlin. This is about religion. This is about growing up Catholic in New York. This is from the 70s. Just listen to all the things that he had to say, all the variations, all the different voices he was able to do, and how he could capture an audience. Even 36 years later, it still is just as relevant, just as funny, just as cutting. This is for George Carlin. We'll see you next week.
I used to be Irish Catholic. Now I'm an American. You know, you grow. Yeah. I was from one of those Irish neighborhoods in New York. One of those kind of parish schools. Wasn't typical. It was Corpus Christi was the name of it. Could have been any Catholic church, right? Our Lady of Great Agony. St. Rita Moreno. Our Lady of Perpetual Motion. What's the difference? What's it called? You know. The church part and the neighborhood part were typical, but the school was not. It wasn't one of those old-fashioned parish kind of prison schools with a lot of corporal punishment and Sister Mary discipline with the steel ruler, right? Oh, my hand! Oh. And you fall 2 years behind in penmanship, right?
Well, he's behind in penmanship, Mrs. Carlin. I don't know why.
He's crippled. He's trying to learn to write with his left hand, you know? We didn't have that. I got lucky, you know, got into a school where the pastor was kind of into John Dewey and progressive education, and he talked the diocese, into experimenting in our parish with progressive education and whipping the religion on us anyway and see what would happen with the two of them there. And worked out kind of nice. There was a lot of classroom freedom. There was no, for instance, there were no grades or marks, you know, no report cards to sweat out or any of that. There were no uniforms. There's no sexual segregation, boys and girls together. And the desks weren't all nailed down in a row, you know. They were movable desks and you had new friends every month. It was nice. Like I say, a lot of classroom freedom. In fact, there was so much freedom that by eighth grade, many of us had lost the faith. Because they made questioners out of us. And they really didn't have any answers, you know. They'd fall back on, well, it's a mystery.
Oh, thank you, Father.
Mystery? I don't know. What's he talking about? A mystery.
Part of class clown was being an imitator, as you probably noticed. But I used to imitate the priests, which was right on the verge of blasphemy, you know. I could do them all rather well. I did Father Byrne the best. Father Byrne was the one who used to celebrate the children's mass. Oh, so that was great, celebrate mass.
Yeah, man.
Father Byrne did the children's mass, did the sermon every week. He used to do parables about Dusty and Buddy. Dusty was a Catholic, and Buddy was not. And Buddy was always trying to talk Dusty into having a hot dog on Friday. And I could do Father Byrne so well that I often wanted to do him in confession, you know? I wanted to get into Father Byrne's confessional one Saturday, maybe a half hour before he showed up, and get in there and hear a few confessions, you know? Because I knew, according to my faith and religion, that if anyone came in there and really thought I was Father Byrne, and really wanted to be forgiven, and performed the penance I had assigned, they would have been forgiven, man. Because that's what they taught us. It's what's in your mind that counts. Your intentions. That's how we'll judge you. What you want to do. Mortal sin had to be a grievous offense, sufficient reflection, and full consent of the will. You had to wanna. In fact, wanna was a sin all by itself. Thou shalt not wanna. If you woke up in the morning and you said, I'm going down to 42nd Street and commit a mortal sin, save your car fare. You did it, man. Absolutely. It was a sin for you to want to feel up Ellen. It was a sin for you to plan to feel up Ellen. It was a sin for you to figure out a place to feel up Ellen. It was a sin to take Ellen to the place to feel her up. It was a sin to try to feel her up. And it was a sin to feel her up. There was six sins in one feel, man. But confession had another, there was another aspect to confession for me. Our neighborhood was right between Columbia University and Harlem, Juilliard School of Music, Grant's Tomb, two seminaries, Jewish Theological and Union Theological Seminary. I said Harlem was there. And then to the north, a Puerto Rican and Cuban section. And as Puerto Ricans began to move into our neighborhood, the diocese, in a rare display of tokenism in the early 50s, sent one Spanish priest, Father Rivera, to hear Spanish confessions. And all the Irish guys that were heavily into puberty would go to confession to Father Rivera. Because he didn't seem to understand the sins, you know? Or at least he didn't take them personally, you know? It wasn't an affront to him. It was no big theological harangue. He didn't chew you out. He was known as a light penance. In and out, free Hail Marys, you're back on the street with Father Rivera, man. Boom, right? You could see the line move. That's how fast he was working. Right? But he wasn't ready for the way Irish boys were confessing at that time in that place.
Huh? Well, bless me, Father, for I've sinned. I would touch myself in an impure manner. I was impure, impurity and impureness. Thought, word, and deed, body, touch, impure, sex, dirty. Impure legs, impureness, touch, impure, dirty body, sex, rub, and covet. Heavy on the covet, Father.
That's okay, men. Tres Ave Marias. Woo!
You'd be home in 5 minutes, you know? The Irish priest, on the other hand, nice guy, but first of all, he recognized your voice because you'd grown up there, you right? He knew everyone. What'd you do that for, George? Oh, God, he knows, man. And the Irish priests were always heavily into penance and punishment, you know? They'd give you a couple of novenas to do, a 9 first Fridays, 5 first Saturdays, Stations of the Cross, a trip to Lourdes. Wow. That was one of the things that bothered me a little about my religion, was that conflict between pain and pleasure, you know? Because they were always pushing for pain, and you were always pulling for pleasure, man. Yeah. There were There were other things that bothered me. Perhaps it's retrospect, you know. I'm seeing them better now. But I think I was troubled, too, at the time by the fact that my church would keep changing rules. I mean, they change a rule anytime they wanted. This law is eternal, except for this weekend.
Special dispensation.
Magic words. Yeah, like eating meat on Friday was definitely a sin. Except for the people in Philadelphia. They were number one in the scrap iron drive. Yeah. They would give it away as a prize, you know. If your parish gave the most money to the Bishop's Relief Fund, hamburgers on Friday. Yeah. Well, and of course, I've been gone a long time now. It's not even a sin anymore to eat meat on Friday. But I'll bet you there are still some guys in hell doing time on a meat wrap, right? I'll be there.
I thought it was retroactive. I had a bologna sandwich. This guy had a beef jerky, right? Tell him what you had.
I'd like to do eternity for a beef jerky. Yeah, because hell wasn't no 5 to 10, you know. Hell was later. Heaven, hell, purgatory, and limbo. Those were the four big places to go. Yeah. Heaven was the only one they showed you pictures of. Drawings, I assume they were drawings, right? Artist's conception of heaven. You'd find that in, sometimes you'd find that in Treasure Chest, the comic book with Chuck White, the Catholic comic book. Yeah, Chuck White fan. Yeah, occasionally you'd see a picture of heaven. Heaven was always a lot of yellow and white light, a lot of vertical lines, a lot of clouds. Might have been clouds, might have been apartment buildings. You weren't really sure, you know. And a lot of tall angels. Did you ever notice that? Except for the cherubs, all the angels, real tall dudes, yeah. And all blonde. They had far too many blondes in heaven, as far as I was concerned. Yeah. Hell, they never showed you any pictures of hell. Hell was real easy to understand. Hell was fire, and anyone can dig fire, right?
Yeah. Hey, hell is like burning 100 Christmas trees and jumping right in the middle, you know?
Purgatory was weird. Purgatory was temporary hell. It was like it was as bad as hell, but you knew you were going home, man. Often wondered if they had, like, short time clubs in purgatory, you know? Little buttons. I'm short. 2 eons, man. Yeah. I could do an eon standing on my head, man. Purgatory. The weirdest of all was limbo. Limbo was where they sent unbaptized babies. The reasoning was it wasn't their fault. Yep. Can't see God if you're not baptized, but you were too young to make the decision. Whip them into limbo. What could limbo have been, man? Welcome to limbo. I think they've since canceled limbo. I'm not completely sure, but I think when they purged a few of the saints, they called off limbo, too. Yeah. Hope they promoted everyone, sent them to heaven, you know, didn't just cut them loose in space, right? Yeah. Once a week, Father Russell would come in for heavy mystery time. And you'd save all your weird questions for Father Russell. In fact, you'd make up strange questions. You'd take a whole week thinking up trick questions to Father Russell.
Hey, Father! Hey, if God is all-powerful, can he make a rock so big that he himself can't lift it? We got him now!
Or else you'd take a very simple sin and surround it with the most bizarre circumstances you could imagine to try to, you know, relieve the guilt in the sin. It would usually end up with the statement,
would that then be a sin then, Father?
It's like here, this is an example. There was one sin, not receiving communion during Easter time. You had to perform your Easter duty. You had to receive once between Ash Wednesday and Pentecost Sunday. And if you didn't do it, it was a mortal sin. Providing, of course, you had said to yourself, hey, I'm not going to do it this year. And there weren't many mortal sins on that, but a lot of guys went to Venial City on Easter duty. And so you would ask the priest, you know, you'd put,
hey, Father, hey,
remember guys would leave their hand up after they got called on, right? And the priest would say, what are you, the Statue of Liberty done?
Oh, sorry, Father. Anyways, Father, hey, suppose that you didn't make your Easter duty, and it's Pentecost Sunday, the last day, and you're on a ship at sea, and the chaplain goes into a coma. But you wanted to receive, and then it's Monday, too late. But then you cross the international dateline.
Yes, I'm sure God will take that into account. Sit down, Lizzie.
Got this friend always talking about the end of the world and such. What it says can't stop it coming. I don't listen all that much. It's not the end of the world that I can't make it through. It's just the end.
That's right, you're listening to WUSB, Stony Brook.